Hello and welcome to the latest exciting installment of the Bad Wolf podcast. Before we go any further, I would just like to apologize for this episode being late. I meant to put it out last week, but it's been so hot that every time I turned my computer on, it just instantly overheated and cut out. So I wasn't actually able to edit it until today, because today's been the first day it's been cool enough to actually put the computer on. So without further ado, here's a short but sweet interview with the lovely Rona Monroe. Hello, I'm now joined by Rona Monroe. Rona, I'm going to ask you the most important question I think you can ask someone these days. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I have had it, yes. I had it 2 weeks ago, and I'd say I returned to myself day before yesterday, probably.
What was it like? I've not had it.
Everyone says the same thing. They go, oh, it's just like a flu now. And that's true. And then you have to remind yourself that having a flu is pretty damn bad, actually. And I think it's the energy level afterwards. It's a long recovery, which is not great if you've got deadlines, but hey-ho.
So, yeah, I asked you on to talk about the target novelization of The Eaters of Light. Yeah. So I guess I'll start by asking, how did you get involved with doing this adaptation?
Well, because I'd written the script for the actual episode, they just offered it to me. And I must admit, at the time, I didn't realise you could refuse. I thought if I said no, someone else would do it, which I suppose is possible. And I thought, well, I've got to do it. So it was quite a scramble, or it felt like quite a scramble. But and I was delighted to say yes.
You're the first classic series writer to come back to the modern era. And what did that feel like?
It's a weird status to have. It does make you feel very old at times. And I sort of see the years roll past, and I think I might retain that unique status. Like, the only person I can see coming up behind me is Ben Aronovich.
Yeah.
He's showing no indications of doing it. He's got quite a lot on, hasn't he? It feels like a privilege, and it feels slightly odd, as if you're holding a legacy, and I sometimes worry I don't hold it reverentially enough. But the fan base does that so beautifully that I feel that they carry that responsibility. I don't have to worry too much.
For a while, you were responsible for writing the last ever episode. What did that feel like?
Of course, I've said this before, that at the time we didn't know what order the episodes were going to go out. So I didn't realise that's what I was doing. I really wish I had done, because the very end of that episode, of course, had to be, as we thought, the end of all Doctor Who, possibly for all time. And I didn't even write it. So Andrew Cartmell, the script editor, wrote that, because I wasn't in the country at the time that became evident. So I think Andrew did a fantastic job, but it wasn't goodbye to Doctor Who forever. But it's something that I would have addressed had I known and had the opportunity.
It goes out on a really sweet note, though, so maybe it worked out for the best.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you would never have, there would never have been a way of signing that off that would have done justice to it. So probably the light touch Andrew gave it was completely appropriate.
What was the writing process like for adapting The Eaters of Light?
It felt like an opportunity. I had a chat with Jenny Colgan, who's done quite a lot of the Target and Who novelizations, and she's a mate, and she's a fantastic novelist. And she was really helpful, because she said, you know, don't panic. It gives you the opportunity to do is to put in the backstory for the characters. And of course, that's in your head. So to make the characters real, you have imagined a backstory, but that gives them a reality on the screen. But you don't want to fill in all the detail, because that's just exposition that would make the audience's eyes glaze over, and there's no time. So it's an opportunity to kind of really fill that in. And I think also I have realized in retrospect, because we were just coming out of 2 years of lockdowns, and I live in a really beautiful rural area of Scotland, and that had really saved my sanity, that kind of relationship between the natural world and the season. And I was so lucky to be able to spend lockdown in an environment like that. And that had been an element in the story anyway, that relationship between the Pictish characters and their environment, and the cycle of the seasons. So it felt very live, and something that was very much imaginatively in the front of my brain. So that was a really nice thing to be able to put on the page.
What were the challenges when it came to adapting the work? And were you able to take ideas that you had to originally scrap to put in the book?
Yes. I mean, the challenges were, I think, just it's so different telling when you're writing a script, the writing muscles you use are about telling all the story in dialogue or in the case of television and film and image. And that never allows you access to direct access to a character's thoughts. And actually having access to a character's thoughts is incredibly liberating because you don't have to think what's the incredibly witty, pithy line that demonstrates what this character's thinking. You can just say this character's thinking. So in some ways it's great. In other ways, so like, for instance, I remember saying, I don't feel like we can go inside the doctor's thoughts. And she said, actually, no, I think you're right. And realised that she'd instinctively avoided that as well. Stuff like that came up and you realised you had to find different ways of telling the story, and some of them were really easy and really liberating, and others you were like, oh, I can't do that. So what do I do to, demonstrate the same things? It was really interesting investigating all that.
What's the writing environment like now on Doctor Who? Is it different to what it was back in the 80s, or is it kind of similar?
Yeah, really different. I mean, it was gorgeous. I mean, but it was such a slick machine, and they're at the height of their success, and they're unbelievably well found. And at that point, the Doctor Who experience was still on the go in Cardiff, and you go down there for, the script meeting or whatever, and you're just in this world of Who, where it is just everywhere you look, and there's fans queuing at the gate, and when it felt like when we were doing that last series of the classic series, there was like four of us in a room of Shepherd's Bush, kind of glumly going, well, they're going to cancel us any minute, aren't they? And the dust motes sort of spiraling in the air. which had a kind of, we are the beleaguered in a bunker fighting the band. There was a kind of really, again, in retrospect, a really kind of defiant energy about which I feel really glad to have been part of. But it was kind of nice to come back and go, whoa, this beast has an engine that will, it doesn't matter whether I'm here or not. It's not nothing about, I'm keeping Who alive. It's like, who is alive? Don't need to worry about that one.
How did you approach writing for a different doctor? Or do you just kind of write it the same and then the actors interpret it?
Well, one of my theories is that I felt that when I was writing it, is that even though the personalities of the different iterations of the doctor have been in a lot of ways very, very different, in another way, fundamentally, the doctor's the doctor.
Yeah.
And that is because, I suppose, the Doctor's backstory, the Doctor is a Time Lord. The Doctor is the Time Lord that's done what they've done. And that is their backstory. That's the spine of their character, and that's not changing. So in terms of writing them as a character, that is a constant. So it's more, what is the spin on this particular iteration? Sure. Stephen actually said, my first sort of drafts of the TV scripts, I almost instinctively went into a rhythm which was much more classic Who,
sure.
Which is not something I would have been aware of, but it's much more. So for instance, you probably saw my episodes, the Doctor and the Companion and Bill were separated. Yeah. That was a really common plot device in classic Who, that split them up, and then you go between the two of them. But it's much less common in the kind of rebooted Who.
Yeah.
And I almost instinctively went for that form of story, and then it probably pushed it further. And in fact, we kind of pulled that back a bit because it wasn't so much the way the stories have been told in the current era.
Sure.
So that was interesting.
Do you remember the exact moment you decided you wanted to become a storyteller?
Oh, gosh. Not the exact moment.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, that's okay. I was pretty young. I was certainly attempting to write novels when I was about 8. And I had I think it's that combination of, if you get praise for something as a kid, you lean into it. And I read really early. So I was really leaning into that really early. And I also had a relative, amazing guy called Angus McVicar, a real trailblazing science fiction writer as well. And he was, he's my Uncle Angus, but he was technically my cousin. Yeah. But my mother's cousin's cousin. But he was a big part of my family and my childhood. And so I knew it was a possible thing to do. And he encouraged me enormously. He wrote an amazing science fiction series back in the 60s called The Lost Planet. Oh, you know of them?
Yeah, I've heard of them. I haven't read them, unfortunately.
But they are great. Yeah. They are really great. Yeah, they're so ahead of the time, actually. And in terms of young adult books and a Scottish setting as the, you know, for the human element, starting in Scotland and then going out. And yeah, they were great. So that was a real inspiration to not only do storytelling, but to kind of very early on be drawn to genre storytelling. For want of a better word.
Sure. Do you prefer writing for TV or theatre or books, or do they each just kind of scratch a different type of itch?
Definitely that. Yeah. The money's a hell of a lot better in film and telly, there's no doubt about that. I think with theatre, you have a great deal more control over your own voice because it's a much smaller team and it's much more script-led and writer-led. But then that has other pressures. And I think with doing TV and film, if you are working with the right collaborators, it's an absolute joy. If you're not, it's hellish. So I do love doing film and telly, but my enjoyment of it is probably very dependent on the producers and script editors, actually, because that's, as a writer, the people you're dealing with more than the director for a much longer period of time. So if you're working with people that you respect and admire and it's mutual, it's very satisfying. If you're not, it's horrific.
So Sam, who normally does this podcast with me, wanted me to ask a question about Ace's sexuality in Survival. He wanted to know what kind of feedback you got from the LGBTQ community about that.
Well, it was so interesting, and it speaks to its time, that I was very determined that there would be a lesbian subtext, or queer subtext, we'd say now. But I knew I had to smuggle it in. And which is what you did back then. In the same way, the late, great Alan Plater said to me, you know, if you want to get what we would, you know, we would now call them the global majority people in a script, what you do is you put it in the description of the character and you give them an unambiguously ethnic name and then you say nothing. And then then the only way they're going to bump that, they would have to actually come out and say something that would make them uncomfortable. So just don't go, oh, we think this character should be South Asian, just do that. And I did that with the Survival. But also with the lesbian subtext, I thought, I'm just going to put this in and I know what this is and I don't know if anyone will pick up on it. Yeah. And the number of people that said to me, they picked up on it. And certainly it was lovely. A lot later, I got the chance to talk to Sophie, and I've forgotten her name, the wonderful woman that played the cheetah woman. That's terrible. I'm sure you can.
Lisa Bauman?
I think it was. Yeah. Anyway, and they knew what they were doing. Yes, it's so great now when you look at characters like Bill and everything that's happened since, and you go, you don't have to smuggle it in. It's there. It's fantastic.
It's amazing how far we've gone in such a short period of time, and for the better. It must have been so frustrating to have to subtly write that.
That's the interesting thing, as I think you're back in the day. You didn't expect to win those battles. So again, it's a sort of guerrilla warfare thing. Yeah. The environment was such, it wasn't like you were disappointed, because you already knew. And you weren't frustrated, you already knew. This is the ground we're standing on, and it's only this, you know, we've only moved this far. So what can I sneak through? So there's a kind of satisfaction in what you could kind of get in under the wall, as it were. but it's great how much things have changed, isn't it?
One of my favourite moments is on the extras for the Blu-ray set, where Ben Aronovich is absolutely staggered that was a subtle, just didn't pick up on it.
Oh, right. Yeah. That is interesting, isn't it? Because I think it did its job in that the people that did pick up, you know, queer people picked up on it, which was kind of what it was there for. So it did, at least it did that much of its job. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
Thank you. Yeah.
Rona, I'm very conscious of the time. I know you're very busy today, so I'm going to thank you very much for joining me. I've really enjoyed this chat. It's been lovely.
Oh, me too. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much. Okay, how great was that? I'd just like to thank Rona for being so generous with her time. And thank you to BBC Books for arranging that. The Eaters of Light, The Fires of Pompeii, Stones of Blood, and The Androids of Tara are all available now.